See who's here. Who's
Oh, Claudette, good to see you.
hello.
Hi, Hannah. Hello, Faye.
Hello,
Good to see
hello.
you,
Hey,
Faye.
Rabbi.
We spent a lovely, hi, Sandra. Faye, we spent a lovely Shabbos meal with your son
I'm
and your
beautiful. Thank
daughter-in-law.
you.
Yeah, it
Very
was
happy.
lovely. It was
Very
very,
happy
very
that
nice.
worked
We
out
played
well.
with Mazal played with Ivri. It was very, very nice. Nadav played with
Beautiful.
Ivri. It was very nice. It was nice to see them, to be with them. Ira, I've long time no see. We're missing Shul.
I know, I'm sorry, I've been a little under the weather.
No excuses, my friend. No
No
excuses.
excuses. Oh no. Actually, but I did. I was speaking with my cousin in Jerusalem yesterday, and I sent him a link
Oh.
to this. So I don't know if he can do
Ooh.
it, but I mentioned
I hope so.
it'll be 9 p.m. Jerusalem time, so he might join in.
I hope so. I hope
Yeah.
so. I hope so. All right. Let me know if he's here.
Yes.
I'll say hello and introduce myself. Barbara, good to see you. I see Jack is joining. So you're like downstairs, or he's downstairs, and you're in a different room. Or the birds. I don't see the birds. They're not here. They're somewhere. Somewhere. Gail, good to see you. Miriam, Linda, hello. Vanessa, good to see you. Tina, oh, not Tina. That's Al. See Al. Al, good to see you. Cantor Meisner, Lechavodou Li. Jeanette is here. I'm glad that she was able to join. Kathy, Pearl. Okay, wonderful. People are joining. Jack, good to see you. Toda rabba sheitztarafta. I'll send again the source sheet for today in the chat box. So we're all going to have it. Let me send it. Here it is. And we'll start. I'll say welcome, everyone. It's so good to see you. Welcome to our fourth class, psychology and the Torah. Muhammad, good to see you also as well. Tadashi
Oh,
Tarach. Good to see you. Shalom, shalom.
okay.
Shavsheret Yafa. Shavsheret Meod Yafa. Kol HaKavod. Tadarabashi Tarach. If you remember, in the past 4 weeks now, that's our fourth week. So we've been doing it for a month. Very exciting. I originally set this series to be five classes, but if you want to have more, we'll have more. We'll see more of this. If you want to do something different, let me know. If there's any request or any class that you want me to give on a specific topic that interests you and you want to share with me, maybe I can do this as well. You all have my email, so it's good to see all of you. Last week we spoke about a different discussion at all. Our question last week was, why didn't Hashem destroy Egypt like he destroyed Sodom? We learned the theory, the psychological theory, that says that what initiates, establishes me as a person is the fact that you consider me as the other. You actually give room for my existence. We said that in Egypt this happened, but in Sodom they really refused to accept the otherness, so-called, of the people, of the strangers that were there. That was last week. Today, I wanted to do a totally new discussion, totally new topic, which I find very interesting because it's exactly the intersection, I should say, between psychology and medicine. All right, so today it's very interesting. We'll do the intersection between psychology and medicine. And before I'll introduce our theory of today and the topic, I'll say that my father-in-law, Priel's father, he's a doctor in Israel, and he is an expert in Israel to what we call the connection between the soul and the body. In other words, he's an expert whenever he works in a clinic and so on. Whenever there is a patient that comes up to him with pain, with he complains on something wrong that he has, the first thing that my father-in-law always says is that probably there's something in his neshama that also maybe bothers him, and a lot of time that comes to expression through the body. And that's exactly what I want to talk about today. Exactly what I want to talk about today. And I want to explain and learn together a very famous story from the Torah, the story of Yaakov's battle with the angel, a story that appears in Bereishit, where Yaakov crosses the river. We'll see the story in a moment. And he wrestles with this mysterious figure, this mysterious character, which we're not sure who he or she or it is exactly. We'll see. There's a lot of questions that arise from this story. And I'll try to explain the story and the message of the story, and maybe light the story in a different color based on a theory. It's not a theory, actually. It's a disorder called the somatic symptom disorder. That's what I wanted to say. Maybe you've heard of the somatic disorder before. Maybe you haven't. It's exactly at the interchange, as I said, between psychology and medicine. So that's what we're about to do today. I found it fascinating to learn the story from that perspective. I'll try to, I hope I will be able to convince you that it's fascinating as well. And here you go. I'll send again for all those who joined us, the sources at the chat box. Intel, good to see you. People are joined. Martin. Oh, I see the bird, Barbara. So how we get to see you. So if this bird is here, we can start going. All right. So take a look. The first page I wrote, I want to explain what the theory exactly is. What's a somatic symptom disorder? So the somatic symptom disorder is a mental disorder manifested through a physiological symptom that is not explained by a medical condition or pathological finding. In other words, a person experiences pain, paralysis, or any other bodily sensation whose origin is primarily psychological rather than a biological malfunction. In other words, think about, maybe it happened to you before, where you could feel pain in one of the muscles. It's real pain. In other words, it's not like the patient, you know, fakes it. It's real pain. It's a real pain that he feels. There's something bad going on. But the doctor doesn't see anything. You go to the doctor checks you, and he says, I'm sorry, I don't see anything. Everything is fine. Everything is okay. I don't understand what's going on. This disorder, what that means, that says the doctor will send you from his clinic to the psychologist's clinic, and he will tell you that the way to treat this pain, this illness, whatever that can be, is not through regular medicine, but rather through therapy, through psychological therapy. That's probably, there is something in your soul, in your neshama, something in your personality that burdens on you, and your body expresses it through pain. You probably heard of it before. Not everyone believes in this. I have to tell you that and not everyone believes that, you know, there is a connection between your personality, your neshama, your soul, you know, and your body. People usually tend to think that if you have pain in your arm, then it's only because there's something wrong with your arm. It can't be that it's because you're distressed or sad or angry or stress or whatever that can be, right? But this disorder really says that a lot of times the doctors, the medical world has no answers, just doesn't know what happens, just tries to check over and over and over again. And the answer really realized in the psychological world, really realize on something that is different, not on this, not a biological, pathological
maybe
kind of
that,
medical
that's
condition.
Maybe that's the difference between psychology and psychology.
Interesting. Why? Interesting.
The psychology also the biologic together with the biology.
Exactly. A medical treatment. That's true. So a psychiatric can give someone prescription to drugs, for example, right? So some drugs that can actually help maybe ease his, thank you, Ruhama, for mentioning this, can give him drugs to actually ease him his condition. The psychologist will use his words, his therapy most of the time, to treat the person, right? That's true. It's not exactly a medical thing, even though we call it mental health. It's still health, but we call it mental health. Anyway, it's a very interesting theory in general. I assume some of you maybe heard of someone who had it. Maybe some of you had it themselves also, where things are not explained medically, but they can be explained psychology, you know, in the world of psychology. Another aspect of this theory of this disorder is the fact that a person who experiences it almost always constantly denies the fact that it's psychological, and he or she will constantly look for any medical explanation possible. They will go to another doctor, and another doctor will go to another checkup. They will go to another doctor. They want to see another opinion here, and they become very stressed around this thing because no one can explain what exactly causes it, and they're sure it's not something within them. They're almost denying the fact that there is a stress or burden or something wrong within them that may cause this thing. All right, so we need to understand this disorder is not just, you know, oh, we know it happened, so we'll go to the psychologist and he will solve this. A lot of times the first step is very hard for the patient to even understand that he needs to go to mental therapy. at first place, because a lot of times they live in this, you know, maybe kind of, they want to ignore it. They want to avoid this kind of thought. And they don't want to agree that this happened. For sure, it's probably something medical. They don't want to go and internalize this kind of a problem. And I want to share with you an interesting thought based in this world by a psychologist. Her name is Dr. Rivka Reicher-Atir. She's an Israeli psychologist. You can see in the first page, I brought a little biography of her. Dr. Rivka Reicher-Atir, that's the woman in the picture. She's a specialist in clinical and medical psychology. That's the field of medical psychology. So far, we haven't talked about medical psychology in the series. We talked about the psychology of development. And last week, we talked about the psychology, as we say, between interactions between people. This is the medical psychology. Very interesting field. A lot of research that is done these days about this, because it was neglected for many, many years. Again, because many, many years, doctors believe that medicine is medicine, psychology is psychology. They just never go together. So this world is, you know, it's a growing world, the medical psychology. So she's an expert in medical psychology, the world-renowned psychologist in the field of medical psychology. She's focusing on therapy and training. She holds a PhD in philosophy from Bar-Ilan University. She comes from the philosophical perspective world with a specialization in bioethics. She initiated a training program for certification studies in forensic psychology, one of the first in the world in Israel. Forensic psychology, which is again a new world that is literally developed in our days as we speak. Dr. Reicher-Atir serves as a senior lecturer at Tel Aviv Yafo Academic College also. And she wrote a paper, which is one of its kind in the world of, again, it's pretty new, like in the past 20 years, 15, 20 years. She wrote a paper, an article, her research that she has done, where she says the following thing. Take a look. I wrote a quotation. Somatic symptom experiences, the fact that what a person, you know, experiences a medical issue, but there's no explanation, no medical explanation behind it, arise from an unconscious desire, she said, to ignore self problems. Where a person has a self problem and he just wants to ignore it, she said. There are times when a person copes with a psychological difficulty, but unconsciously decide to complicate their life by denying or suppressing it from awareness. They're just saying, I don't want to deal with it. I'm literally, and they don't choose to do it. It's you know, subconscious. Their subconscious just tells them, ignore it, ignore it, ignore it. And what happens? What happens then? Since they do not confront the distress directly, it continues to roam in the depth of their soul, sticking its way to ventilation. That's how she called it, ventilation. Much like a pressure cooker searching for an outlet to release steam, she says. The pain or physical difficulties are the body's way of expressing this emotional distress. And based on this research that she has done, she came to the conclusion that the way to treat it is, which is very hard. Let's say we know it's not medical. We know it's psychological. How do you treat it? It's very interesting, right? Like, how do you, anyone had a question? So like, how do you treat it? Like, what's the way? Let's say we know it's psychological, not medical. So what do you do now? If it's medical, you give drugs if you can, go to a surgery. How do you treat something like this? So she says as follows. She says the treatment should be diagnose why the pain is where it is. The first thing you should do, the psychologist should do, is understand why the pain is at this organ, at this part of the body. For example, if a person experiences pain in his arm, and he goes to the psychologist, and this is part of the somatic symptom experiences. What the psychologist needs to do is realize why the patient feels the pain in his arm and not in his head, not in his leg. In other words, what to understand the broader psychological role of the organ in the patient's life. Like, what does the arm, what's the meaning of the arm, the broader meaning of the arm? We'll try to see what it means, but what the arm represents in his life, and that will give us an explanation why the patient feels the pain in his arm, and by that we'll be able maybe to treat it and to heal the person. It's, again, it's all new. This is a new field in psychology. I think it's fascinating. It's a very interesting field for research, for study. And Dr. Rivka Reicher-Atir has this clinic where people go to her after they were diagnosed with this, you know, somatic symptom disorder. She, by questioning them, by discussing with them, by having this kind of, you know, therapy, she's trying to figure out, to trace the root of this pain. Why is it exactly where it is? Why is the pain is in the arm? And when she understands maybe why, she's able to find the correct treatment and to heal the person. That's the somatic symptom disorder and the way to treat it according to Dr. Rivka Reicher Atir. So far, you're probably going to ask yourself, Rabbi, what does this all have to do with Yaakov Avinu wrestling with an angel as a Sefer Bereshit? Like, what? This is really far-fetched. Yes, Claudette?
We know, and people know also, that if they are busy and they're working hard and they have a lot of stress, they get pain in their neck. Nothing is wrong with the neck. Nothing is wrong with the shoulder, but it is painful. What we do, we go for a massage to get rid of it. So it's all psychological, the pressures that we give ourselves that cause the pain in the body.
So what Dr. Rivka here will tell, she will ask, her question will be, so why in the neck? Why not in the leg? Why not in the arm? Why not in the chest? That's her question is to focus on the organ. Her question is to focus on the part of the body that experiences the pain and try to see what it means. That's her chiddush. That's her new thing in the world of psychology. That's why she's such a renowned speaker, renowned psychologist in this field, because she shifted the focus from understanding, treating the pain to trying to understand why the pain is where it is. Mm-hmm. Right? That's for that. Okay?
There's a book. I was trying to find it now. I just couldn't find it. I know I bought this book. It was a Kabbalistic one telling about what the different organs in the body represent and how, it's around the same line of what you're saying. But I just didn't put
that. So I don't know about the world of Kabbalah. Interesting, Faye. I don't know about in the world of Kabbalah and so on. Yeah. I do know because when we lived in Israel, we had a neighbor. She was, I said in English, reflexologist. Maybe you've heard of it, reflexologist. Uh-huh. She was an expert. She was an expert in knowing, for example, she can massage someone's feet, and by pressing different spots on his feet, she's able to heal different other parts of the body. Because this I don't know, right. Probably Eastern kind of philosophy believes that each part of the body is actually connected to a different part on the feet of the person in his foot, and she's able to heal this part of the body by pressing, massaging, whatever in the foot. Look, I'm no expert in this. I can't say if I believe in this or not. I've never went to this kind of treatment before. I don't know. Some people are convinced it works. Some people are convinced it doesn't work. But that's still different than what we're talking about. Because what we're talking here, there's no even physical treatment that can help this person. It's literally only sitting on the therapist's couch and discussing. What does this have to do with Yaakov Avinu? I want to learn together a very interesting story. Probably most of you already heard and know the story. I brought in source number one. It's a story that appears actually out of the blue. I'll give you a context of the story. The story brought in Bereshit 32, Genesis 32, Yaakov Avinu is planning his first time after 20 years, his encounter with his brother Esav. His brother, he knows, wants to kill him because he stole the blessing from him 20 years ago. In those 20 years, Yaakov fled to his uncle Laban. He works there to marry Rachel and Leah. Right. First of all, he worked 7 years for Leah, but then he switched and he gets Rachel instead and all of this stuff for 20 years. And what happens is that now he got a message that Esav wants to meet him. Esav has grown up. He's now a general and he has his own army. And Yaakov is very much afraid from this encountering, and he prepares himself for war, for davening, also with gifts. He wanted with peace offering. He wanted to see what he can do. All right. And right before the encounter, right before he meets Esav, the Torah tells us this mysterious story. Take a look what the Torah tells us. Right before he meets Esav, in source number one, Yaakov rose that night and took his two wives and two maidservants and his 11 children, and he crossed the ford of the Yabok. Yabok is a stream, is a river up north in Israel. He took them and brought them across the river. And he brought across whatever he had. He crossed the river to cross from one side to the end, and he crossed everything they had. He crossed with them once. He left them there. And now what happened? Yaakov was left alone. He crossed them, right? He helped them cross, and he went back to where he came from. Now he was left alone. Yaakov was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. We're told about a man. We have no idea who the man is. We don't know anything about this man. We know that this man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. He saw that he could not prevail over him, and he touched his thigh, and Yaakov's thigh was dislocated when he wrestled with him. The Torah tells us very weirdly, someone couldn't prevail the other. We're not sure if it's the man was Yaakov or the Yaakov was the man. We just have no idea who the Torah talks about because it doesn't give us name of the participants in this battle. We don't know who they're talking about. But we know that Yaakov's thigh was dislocated. He hit Yaakov's thigh, and Yaakov's thigh was dislocated when he wrestled with him. He said, we don't know who. Yaakov, the person, we have no idea who. Please send me forth, because dawn has broken. Okay, I don't know if Yaakov is begging to the other person, please let me go, because it's done. Or the other person is begging Yaakov, let me go, because it's done. We have no idea, right? Because it's done, right? He said, I will not send you forth unless you bless me. What? Very weird, folks. Very, very weird. They're wrestling. Now he wants a blessing. Who wants a blessing from who? Who's asking a blessing from who? Like, we have no idea what's going on. Verse 28. He said to him, what is your name? I don't know who's asking who, but he's asking what's your name. You just wrestled with the person all night long. You don't know even his name. Anyway, what is your name? He said, Yaakov. So now we know the person asked, this person asked Yaakov, what's your name? And Yaakov said, my name is Yaakov. And now famously it says, verse 29, he said, your name will no longer be called Yaakov, but rather Israel, because you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. This person, whatever that is, this mysterious person, gives Yaakov a new name, and he's called Israel, which we are all called Bnei Israel after, and Medinat Israel, and everything, the word Israel comes from here. Yaakov gets a new name from this wrestler. He gets the name Israel. Why? Because you wrestle, the word Sarita, to wrestle in Hebrew is Sarita. Israel comes from the word Lisrot, Sarita, to wrestle. You wrestled with men and God and have prevailed. Again, where did he wrestle with God? Where did, like, we're not really sure what all this is all about. Yaakov asked and said, please tell me your name. Now he asked for Yaakov asked for the other person's name. And he said, why ask regarding my name? Yes, why ask regarding my name? And he blessed him there. Very weird. He refuses to say the name and he blessed him. We don't know who, again, we're not sure who blessed you. Verse 31. Yaakov named the place Peniel because I saw God face to face and my life was saved. We're not sure why Yaakov saw God face to face in this place. And Peniel, Panim, our face. El is God. Peniel is the face of God. That's why Yaakov called this place Peniel. And verse 32, the sun rose upon him and he passed Penuel. Very weird. What does it mean the sun rose upon him? The sun rose. What's upon him? Like the sun only rose for him? He's the only person who the sun rose for. What's upon him? The sun rose, right? For the entire world, the entire area, the sun rose, right? And he passed Penuel, and he was limping on his thigh. And we're told that he's limping on his thigh. He has the pain now in his thigh because what happened? Because he wrestled. Therefore, now take a look. The most shocking part of all is this verse 33. The Torah stops the story, right? Stops the story and tells us, the reader, therefore, the children of Israel do not eat this. This sciatic nerve, it's a kind of a nerve in the leg of the cow, all right, in the leg of every mammal, which is by the thigh joint to this day, because he touched the socket of Yaakov's thigh and the sciatic nerve. Once again, let's open the door for Priel. Sorry. So we're told, very shockingly, that we do not eat this part of the leg, this nerve, we're not allowed to eat it because it's on the thigh of the animal. Why? Because Yaakov was hurt on his thigh and he's limping on his thigh. So many questions. I don't know how I'm going to have the time to answer all those questions. But I think what I want to try to do is to understand this. First of all, I see that the thigh here is a very important element in the story, right? Mm-hmm. We're not allowed to eat this part of the thigh of the animal because Yaakov limped on the thigh because he was struck on the thigh. I want to follow. I want to suggest we'll do it together. I want to follow Dr. Reicher Atir's a theory, and maybe to try to trace, maybe the pain that Yaakov feels is actually this somatic pain. In other words, let's try to understand, first of all, why does Yaakov feel pain in his thigh? What does the thigh represent? What does the thigh mean? Why exactly in his thigh he feels this pain? And that might help us to understand the greater story. What is the story doing here? What exactly happened? Who is Yaakov wrestling with? What's this blessing? Why did the son just raise on him only? And what all this has to mean for the sake of this class? All right. So we'll do it by first of all starting to understand what is the thigh, what does the thigh represent, and why is he limping on the thigh, and why are we not allowed to eat this specific part of the thigh of any kosher animal? By the way, in Hebrew it's called gid hanasheh. That's the name in Hebrew. It's called gid hanasheh. It's a special part on the thigh that also today in a kosher shchit, a kosher slaughterhouse, we have to remove it and not eat it. I once gave a shiur in Shiur Tefillah exactly about this. What is this nerve? Where do you find it? And so on. Very interesting. But we're not allowed to eat this. It can be a kosher animal, a cow or a sheep or whatever. If it's a mammal, mammals have this nerve. Human beings also have this nerve. And we have to remove this nerve before we can eat this meat. All right? So I want to try to see, what does the thigh represent? What does the thigh represent in the world of Yaakov? And why, maybe, according to Dr. Reicharati, we can say that Yaakov felt pain in his thigh. All right? That's what I want to do. Question before we do, we go on the journey? Okay, so take a look. So let's take a look. Take a look, first of all, in source number 2. I want to go back and I want to explain. I want to see in Tanakh, in the Torah, where do we find the thigh? What's the meaning of a thigh? The person's thigh in the Torah. It's a very interesting question to ask. You ever ask yourself, and for any different part of the body? No, but let's see what a thigh means. That's very interesting. We'll see. The thigh is written in different stories, actually, around the Torah. The first place we see it is in source number 2. Source number 2, I'll give you context before we read the source, is Abraham. When Abraham is commanding his servant, Eliezer, to go find a wife for his son, Yitzchak, right? Abraham wants his son to get married. He sends his servant to go and find a wife for his son. He wants his servant to swear that he will only look for a Jewish wife. All right? He wants his servant to swear that when he's going to look for a shidduch for his son, this woman will only be a kosher Jew, a kosher woman, a Jewish woman. Take a look at verse number 2. Abraham said to his servant, the elder of his household, who ruled over all that was his, please, place your hand under my thigh. Okay, place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear in the name of Hashem, God of the heavens and God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose midst I dwell. Rather, you will go to my land and my family and take a wife for my son, Yitzchak. What he's doing is, he's telling the servant to put his hand under Avram's thigh and swear. The very weird way to swear. All right, hold that thought for a moment. But we see that Avram is telling him, take your hand, place it under my thigh, and swear that you will only find a shidduch to my son, only a Jewish woman from a good household, from my family. Someone that is Jewish and good. Swear you will do this. All right, that's the first time we see the thigh. Is where Abraham says to his servant, swear to do it. Second place we see the thigh, in source number 3, is towards the end of the life of Yaakov. When Yaakov is about to die, and he's down in Egypt, and he goes to Yosef. Yosef is in Egypt, and he has 2 children, 2 sons, Ephraim and Menasheh. And before he goes to bless them, to give them the bracha, Yesimcha Elokim ke Ephraim vechim Menasheh, Yivarchecha Hashem, we say on Shabbat, Yivarchecha Hashem Yishmerecha, but before you give them the bracha, and all this kind of stuff, Yaakov and Israel are together. It says in source number 3, before Yaakov died, source number 3, it says as follows, Israel's time to die drew near, and he called for his son, for Yosef, and said to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, please place your hand under my thigh. Again, Yaakov is asking Yosef, take your hand, place it under my thigh. Why? And deal with me with steadfast kindness. Please do not bury me in Egypt. He again makes Yosef to swear, to promise that he will not let his father be buried in Egypt, but after his father, after Yaakov died, they will bury him in Canaan, in Eretz Israel. Yaakov doesn't want to be buried in Egypt. He wants to be buried in Israel, and he makes his son swear to him that he will do it by what? By taking his hand, telling Yosef, take your hand and place it under my thigh. All right? Very interestingly, when I lie down, he says, with my fathers, you shall carry me from Egypt and bury me in their graves. He said, I will do as you have spoken. He said, swear to me. And he swore to him. Israel bowed at the head of the bed. Again, we see that there's an idea of swearing. He wants him to swear that he is going to do it. He wants him to promise that he will do something. And in ancient days, we see the way to promise something is to take the hand of a person and put it under the person's thigh. Now, very interestingly, the rabbis ask, what does it all mean? What is this weird ceremony? Is that like a Jewish ceremony, which we don't do anymore? Today, if you want to swear something, you write down your signature. That's how you know, that's how you commit to something. Back in old days, according to some commentaries, like we'll see in source number four, take a look in the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra said in source number four, I know it's not part of the rules to give commentary in this class, but I had to give Ibn Ezra here as well. So take a look in source number four. Ibn Ezra says, it was customary in those days for a person to place his hand under the thigh of his master. Its meaning being, if you are subject to my authority, place your hand under my thigh. The Lord then set on his servant's hand. By doing so, the servant, as it were, said to the master, my hand is under your authority to do your will. And he finishes and says, this custom is still followed in India. That's what Ibn Ezra says. Again, Ibn Ezra lived thousands of years ago. So I try to check if there's still a custom like this in India today, in modern India, to swear or to promise by putting one's hand under the thigh of the other person. I didn't see anything about that. Anything. I'm not sure it's still a thing. Maybe some, you know, I don't know, groups in India. But what Ibn Ezra says is that that was a way for someone to demonstrate authority. All right? If someone wanted to demonstrate authority, he used to say, I want to sit on your hand, put your hand under my thigh. I want to sit on your hand. And that's how you agree, you consent that I'm your authority. That's the Ibn Ezra. So we see two ideas in the Torah that are pretty much the same, where the thigh appears when someone promises something. All right, hold the thought, hold this in your mind, we'll get back to it soon. A third place where we see the thigh is totally different, totally, totally different. I brought it in source number five. I'll give you context to the source before we see it. We're talking about Isha Sota. What's an Isha Sota? Isha Sota is a woman that is, I want to say, suspected. She's not convicted yet. But she suspected that maybe she betrayed her husband and she has another relationship outside of marriage. All right? Maybe she has a lover. Maybe she has someone outside of her relationship with her husband. And she's only suspected that she is. She was not convicted yet. All right? And back in the times of the Mikdash, there used to be a test. There used to be a test to check if a husband suspected that his wife, you know, cheats on him. Then he used to take her to the temple. All right. And there was a special test that they used to do led by the high priest, led by the Kohen. So take a look what happened then. What was that, the test? How could they do that? So it's number five. The woman would go to the temple and then what? The priest shall cause the woman to swear with the oath of cursing. And the priest shall tell the woman, may Hashem make you a curse and an oath among your people. When Hashem allows your thigh to fall away and your body to swell, wait a minute with that. We'll try to see what that means. And this water, that and what's the test? The test is the Kohen gives her water that are mixed with special ashes of a name of God is written on a note. And the name of God, the full name of God is written on the note. This is burnt. The acid of the note with the name of God is mixed inside water that comes from a special stream mixed with a special plant. They mix it all together, and then the Kohen hands this glass of water with ashes to the woman. She needs to drink it. And if she's okay and she's alive after it, then everything is okay. Then we prove that she did not cheat on her husband. But if God forbid she cheated on her husband, she will die from this water. She will die from this drink. Now, only that story itself has so many questions you probably all of you have. I see Vanessa's face. She's like, what's going on here? This is wild. I know this is wild. I understand. There's a lot to be said about this. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to go through this. You know, this deserves a class on its own to try to understand what exactly that all means and how does it work and all of this. But you should be aware that in the time of the temple, again, primitive times, we're talking about thousands of years ago, that was the way to prove in the temple that a woman betrayed or did not betray her husband by giving her this special water. It's called maim me'alein, called bitter water. He used to give her this water, she used to drink, and if she did not cheat on her husband, she will be alive, and if not, she will die from those waters. All right, that's her punishment. Now, the way that the Kohen, the priest is, what happened here? Sorry. the way that the Kohen, the way that the priest is actually checking it or telling her, look, you better drink this water. If not, you will die. He doesn't say the word die. He said, your thigh will fall away. That's the word that the priest is using. He says, if you actually betrayed your husband, your thigh will fall away, meaning you will die. That's so weird. Why are you using the word thigh? That's the way to explain death. Your thigh will fall away. Take a look and it continues. Verse 22, and this water that brings the curse will go into your bowels and make your body swell, and your thigh will fall away. The woman shall say, amen and amen. In verse 27, when he has made her drink the water, then it shall happen if she is defiled and has committed a trespass against her husband, that the water that causes the curse will enter into her and become bitter, and her body will swell, and her thigh will fall away, and the woman will be cursed among her people, and she will die. Why does the Torah use the word, her thigh will fall away? That's a very weird and odd way to explain that she will just die. It's a very odd way to say it. I want to say, this source and the other two sources all have one thing in common. First of all, they all talk about the thigh. The thigh repeats itself in both in the stories where one is commanded to put his hand under the other's thigh and also here. But I want to ask you, what do all three examples that I just brought have in common? When we see the thigh, we see different cases where thigh appears in the Torah. What can we learn? What can we draw a line between those three sources? What can we learn? Is there any common sense between all the three examples?
It's about vows and swearing.
Vows and swearing, exactly. I would maybe even elaborate a little bit more. I would use maybe different words because there is swearing also in the third part, but like, how would you call it, Clint? Like, I would maybe sharpen a little bit more. Anyone?
I think they're trying to make the person become committed to whatever they're doing at the time.
Commitment. Yeah. And if I may add, I would say, folks, all those three examples where thigh is actually mentioned are all dealing with loyalty.
Loyalty, yes.
Right? Loyalty, that's the word that I'm talking about. Truth. Loyalty. Right? Mm-hmm. Truth. Loyalty. We want to make sure that someone is speaking the truth, that he's on the right path, that he is loyal to someone else. In the first two examples, we saw that Abraham wants to make sure that his servant is loyal to him, and he for sure will bring Yitzchak a wife that is Jewish. The second example, we saw that Yaakov want to make sure that Yosef is loyal to him, and Yosef will actually bury him after he dies in Israel. And in the third example we saw, we're talking about loyalty between a husband and a wife. We're checking the loyalty of the woman in the eyes of her husband. And we're doing it by giving him the water, and we use the word thigh to explain what happens if she's not loyal, her thigh will fall. In those three examples, the thigh is mentioned in context of loyalty, of truth. We want to check the truth. We want to check the loyalty of someone. We want to make sure that someone goes on the right path. He's not a cheater. There's no cheating involved. Everything is good. Everything is straightforward. Everything is clean, right? The thigh represents that loyalty, represents the cleanliness of the person, represents integrity, represents honesty. That's why the thigh is there. So far, by tracing the thigh in the Torah, we can see the thigh represents the truth, the loyalty. Now, why would the thigh represent loyalty in the Torah? What do you think? Why would the thigh represent loyalty? Anyone? What do you think? Why would the thigh, of all parts of the body, will represent loyalty?
Because the thigh is actually representative of a sexual organ. And that's how it's used often in the Torah, that Yelech represents a sexual organ. And that has always been the sign of loyalty and Jewish understanding, especially
that's
in the
true. Torah. Very nice. So beautiful, Kathy. Where have you heard that or read that?
I know it.
But wonderful, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. So what Kathy says is perfectly true. Rashi says that Rashi brings it. Rashi says that the yarech, the thigh, represents a sexual organ in a certain way. And the most basic loyalty between human beings are around this area, the area of sexual loyalty. All right, that's like the most basic loyalty between human beings. Like if you don't have this, then you don't have anything. And the thigh is represented in the Torah as an organ, as a part that represents loyalty because of the sexual aspect into it, perspective into it. It's very interesting. Rashi, there's a very interesting Rashi on this idea that that Abraham told the servant to put his hand under the thigh, and he tied it to Brit Milah also. There's a very interesting idea behind it. But really, the idea is the thigh is considered to be in the Torah a sexual part in a certain way, and the basic of the loyalty would be sexual loyalty. That would be the most basic idea of loyalty in a relationship between partners. That would be the most basic idea of loyalty. So in the Torah, the thigh represents loyalty. Now back to the story about Yaakov. Now that we know thigh represents loyalty, I want to ask, so the fact that Yaakov feels pain in his thigh, following Dr. Rivka Reicher at tears, fear, right? What can we maybe understand from here, folks? Maybe we should say that Yaakov feels pain in his thigh because the thigh represents loyalty, and maybe there's a problem of loyalty in Yaakov's life. Mm-hmm. And that's the second part of my class, because now I want to ask, where do we see that Yaakov has a problem with loyalty? And I think this is an easier part to answer.
There's a loyalty, father-in-law.
Exactly, as you all say. Exactly. So let's see this. Take a look, for example, in source number 6, the beginning of his life, the real first part of his life, as he goes out of his mother's womb, in source number 6, right? The first emerged ruddy, right? All of him hairy, like a cloak. So they called him Esav. Afterwards, his brother emerged, his hand holding on the heel of Esav. So he called him Yaakov, and Yitzchak was 60 years old when they were born. We see that only when the first thing we know about Yaakov, that he's going out and he's trying to chase his brother and trying to go first. And he holds the ankle, the heel, right, of his brother, and then he goes after him. The first thing we know him that he's trying to chase his brother and want to be go out first. You know, so far, so good. But the first thing we see. Second thing we see later on is where Yaakov famously, as he said, buys the birthright from Esav. Right? We can read it as a positive way, like many commentary read it in a very positive interpretation. But I also want to say there's a lot of, I think, criticism in the Torah against what Yaakov did. I brought in source number 7. Take a look at source number 7, where he buys the bechorah, the birthright. Yaakov cooked the stew, and it came from the field, and he was famished. Esav said to Yaakov, please give me a gulp from this red stuff, and as I am famished. Therefore, he was named Edom. Yaakov said, instead of giving to his hungry brother, giving him some stew, what did he say? Sell me now your birthright. Mm-hmm. No, there's a problem with loyalty here. Like, they're brothers. Like, why are you conditioning your, you know, helping your brother with all the fact that his brother, the Midrash and the Parshanim, they all say how bad Esav is and how bad son he was to his parents and how he would cheat them and lie to them. And they justify Yaakov's action by this. But from the, you know, the pshat, from the simple text itself, from the story, seems like Yaakov here is, again, he's like, he's not acting loyalty, not acting in the true way that he should have done. It's not straightforward, right? Again, we can see that he conditions the help, the assistance to his brother, that he will sell in the birthright, right? Again, source number 8. That's maybe the most interesting source here. Yaakov literally lies to his father under the instructions of his mother and steals the blessing from his brother. He goes and he dresses up like his brother. He puts hair on himself. He goes to his father, and his father asks him, who are you? He says, I'm Esav. He lies to his father. There's a problem of loyalty between him and his brother, between him and his father. We see it over and over and over again. Think of verse number 8 when he steals the bracha. Yaakov said to his father, I am Esav, your firstborn. I have done as you have spoken to me. Rise, please, sit up and eat from my game so that you may bless me. He said, I'm Esav. He's lying to his father due to the problem of loyalty. Yitzchak said to Yaakov, please approach that I may feel you, my son. Are you indeed my son Esav or not? Again he asked him. And he approaches and again he asked him, are you my son Esav? And again and again and again and again. And we know the story where he actually steals the blessings from Esav. He fools his blind father. He takes the blessing from Esav. And we know what Esav said. But the last verse, number 8, the last verse 36, Esav said, is that why he's named Yaakov? Because he deceived me twice. He took my birthright, and behold, now he took my blessing. Again, we see that Yaakov, and I'm putting all the midrashim and all the commentary aside where they justify everything that Yaakov does, only from the story itself, where we can criticize Yaakov's actions, we see that there is an inherited problem in Yaakov's loyalty. There is a problem in Yaakov's truth. Everything that happens to him happens in, I want to say, there's never, the right, straightforward, clean way. And by the way, it's not only him doing to others. It also happens to him by others. When Laban. Our brothers are number nine, Laban, his uncle, as we say, switched. He cheated him, right? He deceived him. He switched between the women, right? In source number nine, when he marries Leah, he thought he was marrying Rachel. He married Leah. And it says source number nine, in the morning, behold, she was Leah. He was surprised. I married the wrong woman, right? She was Leah. He said to Laban, what is this that you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I worked with you? Why have you tricked me? Again, there's trickery all the time. There is all the life of Yaakov until now is filled with trickery, with problems with loyalty, with cheating, whether it's him to others, whether it's others to him. Everything that happened so far seems to go on the wrong path. Everything goes on the wrong path. The loyalty isn't a problem. And also another example, if you're not convinced so far, source number 10. Even when he goes away from Laban, he does it by escaping. By escaping. Take a look at source number 10. He says, and you know that I worked for your father with all my might, but your father toyed with me and switched my wages 10 times, yet God did not allow him to harm me. And right afterwards, he doesn't tell Laban he's going, he's just escaping. His wife and just goes. He just goes. All right, we see that Yaakov's life is filled with those problems, with those loyal problems, with this loyalty problem. Whether it's something he does to others, whether it's something that things are done to him. Now, only this for itself is worthwhile maybe discussing what causes Yaakov to be this very, I want to say in his early stages, a problematic character. Because based on the pshat, this is a problem. This is a problematic behavior. Based on the pshat, we can say that, we can criticize this with all the respect to Yaakov, obviously, well, to one of the avot, we can still say, like, we don't want our kids to learn how to behave like this. Like, we don't want our kids to read Yaakov and be a role model to them without bringing Rashi, Radak, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, Rashbam, there's tons of books, like, behind the tons of books of commentary to bring into the game so they will actually learn how to behave. Because if it's only for the story, I wouldn't give it to Ivri in 2-3 years to read, or 4 years to read, and he will know what to do. That's not a good role model. We have a problem with loyalty here. We have a problem where we say in the thigh. Now, back to our story. Back to the story and when he wrestled with this person, with this mysterious person. This story happens like right here. After all the stories you just saw, after all the problems, when he escapes Laban and he goes to meet Esav, after all of this happened, we establish that thigh represents loyalty, and we establish that Yaakov suffers with problems in his loyalty. So what is the story all about? Take a look back. Go all the way back now to source number one. All the way back to our story. I want to read it again. But now put everything we said in mind. And take a look on the way that I want to read the story right now. I think it's a beautiful way of reading. Rabbi Eliyahu Fran read it that way. I think it's a beautiful way of reading. Take a look at source number one. He rose, Yaakov rose that night, and took his two wives and two maidservants and his 11 children, and he crossed the ford of the Yabbok. He took them and brought them across the river, and he brought across them whatever he had. Yaakov was left alone. Why is it important for us to say that he was left alone? He was left alone because there was no one there now to question him. Now the person is with himself, and if he's alone, how could be there a man that wrestled with him? In other words, I want to argue, following Rabbi Eliyahu Fran, I want to argue that Yaakov, unlike, and it's not the traditional, not the classical way of doing it, that Yaakov wrestled with himself.
With himself.
We should read this story. We should read this story as Yaakov wrestling with himself. Why with himself? Take a look. Why with himself? Yaakov was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. A man is Yaakov himself. Yaakov is standing in front of those waters. He sees himself. Yaakov goes through this psychological therapy right now, which is this is the battle. This is the revenue he goes through, and he needs to be changed after this. Now he will need eventually to leave the problem with loyalty, the deceiving, the cheating, the wrong path is behind him,
And it will need to be proved that she can actually be the leader of the Jewish people, to be the leader of folk tribes, to be the leader of what's going to be Am Yisrael that will come out of him. And take a look. He saw that he could not prevail over him. And he touched his thigh. The thigh represents loyalty. That's the really essence of the entire thing. He needs to change his loyalty. He needs to change the problem that he had with his loyalty. And Yaakov's thigh was dislocated when he wrestled with him. He said, and again, the fact that we don't know who said what exactly happened is because it's not another person. We can read it as actually Yaakov with himself. He said, please send me forth because dawn has broken. Not for no reason it happened at night. Night represents what? What does night represent? Exactly. Sun represents the clarity when you see everything. It's hard to do this at night. Night represents exactly when we're not sure what's going on. All right, it's all mysterious, but sun is here. I don't want to face myself, says Yaakov. I don't want to face those parts in me. I don't want to do this. Let me go. He said, I will not send you forth unless you bless me. No, you need to bless. Yaakov, your blessing that you stole from your brother, that you deceived your father and you stole from your brother, this blessing, you need to re-own it. You need to reclaim your ownership, but you need to do it in the right way now. You can't do it in the bad way that you did it before. So there needs to be a reclaiming of the blessing. He said to him, what is your name? And he said, Yaakov. But what is Yaakov? He saw. Yaakov means the one who always follows the other, who always held the ankle, right? The Akev of his brother Esav and tried to chase him, to always get things before him. He says, no, your name will no longer be called Yaakov, but rather Israel. The changing of the name of Yaakov represents the changing of the character. Yaakov is the past. Israel is the future. That the new Yaakov, that the Yaakov that reclaimed the bracha, that leaves the Akev behind, that leaves the problems in loyalty, the problems with truth, the chasing, the deceiving, leave it behind. You're recalled Israel because you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. You have striven with God, your spiritual journey. You wrestled with who you are. You wrestled with what you're supposed to be. And with men, you literally, all your years so far, you wrestled with everyone around you. You tried to win everyone surrounding you. Now you will prevail. Now you will reclaim your bracha. Yaakov asked him, said, please tell me your name. And he said, why are you asking regarding my name? And he blessed him. He said, no, you're Yaakov. You're Israel. You're no older name anymore. Nothing old anymore. Now you're in a new phase of your life. You're now Israel. Yaakov named the place Pneel. Why did he call it Pneel? Because they saw God for the first time, face to face. And my life was saved. His life was saved because now he really deserved to be the leader of Am Israel. He saw the face of God because now for the first time, he looked at God face to face, looked at the truth face to face, at loyalness face to face. God is a God of Emet. He's a God of truth. And now that's where he saw him for the first time. Yaakov named this place Neiel. The sun rose up upon him. Now we understand that it's like a metaphor. The sun rose upon him. It's like, it's a new day. It's a new light, right? Mm-hmm. He's a new character now. He's a new character as he passed Neiel. And he was limping on his thigh. Why on his thigh? Because that's the problem that he had. That's the loyalty. That's the source, the root of his pain, this metaphorical pain, this somatic pain. Therefore, we're commanded, the children of Israel were called, not the children of Yaakov. We are the children of Israel. We follow Israel. We don't follow Yaakov. Yaakov is the past. Israel is the future. We are the children of Israel. We do not eat this specific organ. We do not eat because it's for us to remember what loyalty is. It's for us to remember that we need to be loyal. We need to follow the truth. We need to claim what we own, but on the right way, not in deceiving, not in cheating, not in stealing, not in escaping, but in the right, correct, direct way. And I think we can summarize it and see it in that way, that the entire story is lit up in a different light. If we take Dr. Rivka Reiter Atir's idea that a pain represents, you know, the organ represents something that is broader, and we said this pain that he had in his thigh represents loyalty, and we saw, we proved that Yaakov suffered from loyalty all his life, whether he thinks he did to others, the thing that has done to him. We saw that we said maybe this story is a story where Yaakov actually wrestled with himself. And I want to show you and finish with the last source number 11, beautifully written by Rabbi Eliyahu Fran, Morid Rabbi Eliyahu Fran. He also read it that way. And he says it's followed source number 11. He says,
Jacob stands alone on the bank of the stream, struggling with his reflection in the water, with the crooked, despiteful, and hidden part of himself, the path of thieves, stealing blessings, schemes, thoughts, and hearts, all happening in the darkness of night. Jacob has led his life thus far under the shelter of darkness. He hides beneath the blindness of his father when he steals Esau's blessing. And in the absence of Laban when he escapes, stealing his heart. As the internal struggle unfolds within Jacob's soul, seeking to emerge from darkness into light and break free from this crooked path, his voice demands attention. It clings to the dark path, commanding him to send forth, for the dawn has risen. For unto him if he delays until daylight. But the man, so-called, the voice opposing Jacob within himself, seizes the opportunity before the encounter with Esau and insists on regaining the blessing anew. I will not let you go unless you bless me. It seems that this is the main emphasis of the nocturnal motive in this story. And perhaps it is also the profound meaning of the expression, and the sun rose for him. At the end of the process, as the light of the day breaks upon Jacob's life, he will internalize the measure of righteousness and emerge from darkness into light. The sun rays here is not an astronomical event, but an internal metaphor. When Jacob completes the process, the sun arises for him, and he will step out of the darkness into the light. I had to agree to bring Reverend Frank's beautiful words to explain this. I think it's a beautiful way to see it. If we can summarize, I'll say, we started by asking so many questions, but we can see again that maybe using a psychological theory that, again, has nothing to do in the Jewish world. Again, she's an Israeli and she's Jewish, but it's no commentary, no rabbi, no parshanim here, just the text, the beautiful stories of the Torah and the beautiful research that we're doing on the mental of people, on the psychology behind people, can help us understand and maybe light up this different shadow on Yaakov Avinu and what happened to him with himself, the wrestling that he had with himself on this river of your book before he meets again his brother Esav, and before he becomes the father of those 12 tribes who will become later on Israel. Thank you very much. That's what I wanted to tell you today. If you have any questions, I'm sure you have a lot to discuss here. I think there's a lot to be said after this class. As usual, if you want to email me later on for questions or feedback, you have my email. I'm here for questions, but I want to thank everyone for coming here. I'll stop the recording now, and we'll have some time for questions. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming.